Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Dogs Program. We are the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools Program, and we're here every week to defend and promote public education. We've got a pretty full program for you today, so I'll get right into it. This week, obviously, is the first week back for school for many, and the AEU Victoria have applied to the Fair Work Commission to conduct a ballot of members to endorse protected industrial action, including stop work. Let's hear from them now.
With term underway today, there is no time to waste. Our industrial action campaign kicks off, and this morning we lodged an application with the Fair Work Commission so that members can vote to endorse stop work action and bans and limitations on the work that's performed. That's all because teachers, ES and school leaders are being deeply disrespected by the Allan Labor government. We've continued to negotiate throughout December and January. The only pay position of the government is a measly 3%. It's totally unacceptable. And by the way, there's not even an offer at all anyway. What it means is that the government has done nothing to actually address the fact that our schools are the lowest funded in the country and that our teachers are the lowest paid, with ES and school leaders undervalued as well. Something's got to give, and that's going to be in the form of an industrial campaign unless the government comes to the table. If you haven't joined the union yet, do it today. Get on board. We need you as part of our campaign for significant pay increases and conditions to match.
So that clip was from the 27th of January, and not 24 hours later, they had an update.
I wanted to give you a really important and short update about the union's application to the Fair Work Commission to be able to take protected industrial action and allow AEU members to vote. This morning, the Allan Labor government have done an anti-union thing. They've said to the Fair Work Commission that union members shouldn't even be allowed to vote about whether they take protected industrial action. It's bad enough that they've decided it's okay for our schools to be the lowest funded in the country. It's bad enough that teachers are the lowest paid in the country. It's bad enough that ES and school leaders are undervalued as well. But they've now decided that it's not okay for teachers, ES and principals to vote to take industrial action. That's outrageous. We're going to fight it. And if you're a union member, look out for updates via email. But otherwise, if you haven't joined the union yet, get on board today. We need you to be part of the campaign for significant pay increases and conditions to match.
That's right. The Allan government is trying to stop the teachers' union from fighting for what they deserve. We'll be following this quite closely. If you are a teacher, you're an educational staff within a school community, join your union, get active, because it matters now. Now, we're going to go to our press release, and I'll pass you over to Andy.
And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1059. Public education makes economic sense for public school parents. Research conducted by school finance group Futurity using school fee data from Australia's Curriculum Authority and interviews from 2,500 parents about their spending habits indicates that a public education costs parents much, much less than a private one. However, it also indicates that the principle of free education is becoming a pipe dream for would-be parents. The result, young couples are doing their sums and no longer having many children, if they decide to have any at all. On January the 14th, 2026, William Tun at The New Daily lists the following figures. For a child starting school in 2026, a government education will cost families in major cities $113,594. Private schooling comes in at $247,174, and sending them to an independent school for 13 years will cost $369,594. In regional and remote areas, families will pay $100,395 for a government education, $223,874 for Catholic, and $230,144 for independent schools. Melbourne topped the capital cities in government school costs at $121,202, while regional and remote Queensland parents faced the steepest education bill of $108,647. Government school fees made up 13% for metro and 5% for regional costs. The remainder goes to add-ons such as outside tutoring, transport, school camps and uniforms. Canberrans will spend the most for a Catholic education, while regional and remote Queenslanders pay the highest fees at $273,494. Independent schools are most expensive in Melbourne, costing $435,902, while Western Australia is the priciest for regional and remote schools at $275,639. A third of respondents said they turned to credit debt, while others cut back on family holidays and even worked more to afford quality education for their kids. More than half said they relied on others, including grandparents, to pay for their children's education. Families have tightened their spending as concerns increase about Australian schools being fully funded, according to the Australian Council of State School Organisations. When the household budget is under pressure, things like sport and camps and upgrades are the first things that are scaled back, Interim Chair Peter Garrigan said. He said the real test was whether every child could participate fully without money being a barrier, as parents turn to the bank of grandparents for help. Australia's society should be able to support everyone to do that, Garrigan said. In Australia, 63% of students are enrolled in government schools, 20% in Catholic schools, and 17% in independent schools, according to the Bureau of Statistics. The Dogs comment, Australian parents and their children have been used and abused by the private religious sector. They play upon the best parental instincts to cause insecurity, sectarianism and class competition rather than community spirit in family and government finances. This is why Dogs have always promoted a free, secular and universal public education system and opposed the taxpayer funding of the private sector. Even so, the 63% of parents who choose a public education system, at the end of the day, are still receiving as good an education as they will ever receive at a private institution for a fraction of the cost. Why? The private sector is parasitic on the major public system and undermines the whole Australian educational enterprise, as our international results prove again and again. Our 19th century forebears understood this and withdrew state aid to private schools. When will we ever learn?
Thanks, Andy. And now here's an article by Jane Caro, titled, How Public School Students Will Start the Year. On the final day of school last year, a public high school catering to a very disadvantaged community presented its students with a gift pack. It included a young adult novel, a classically popular picture book so the student could read it to a younger relative or friend, a voucher for the municipal pool donated by the local council, a toiletry pack including deodorant, shampoo and conditioner, chocolates and a pack of Tim Tams. This was followed by a presentation and barbecue, and every student was given ice creams. As the principal walked through the playground, she passed a student clutching his gift bag and sucking on two paddle pops, one on each side of his mouth. He stopped her. This is the best school in Sydney, miss, he said blissfully. I know, she replied. Most Australians would turn their noses up at this school. It is located in an economically disadvantaged suburb, the kind that well-off people drive through quickly if they have to visit at all. The children it teaches are overwhelmingly from the lowest socioeconomic group, according to the My School website's Index of Community Socioeducational Advantage. More than two-thirds of its students are from families in the lowest income quartile. Almost half are from immigrant, refugee and non-English speaking backgrounds, and Indigenous students are a sizable cohort. The school cares fiercely about all of them. Like virtually every other public school in Australia, it is underfunded according to the Schooling Resource Standard, the SRS, the measure of how much funding a school requires to meet its students' educational needs, established by the landmark Gonski Review of 2011. This school does receive disadvantage loadings in line with the Gonski recommendations, but the degree of difficulty these students face means its SRS is still out of reach. Most of this school's students are going on to tertiary education, however, thanks to the dedication of its teachers, but also to outreach by universities, such as the University of Technology Sydney's you at Uni Academy, which are actively seeking more diverse and disadvantaged students. Nevertheless, despite the previously mentioned appreciative student, nobody is boasting about attending this school. This does not mean that they don't love it or that it does not do brilliant work. Our society simply no longer judges schools according to their merit, but rather according to the social status of the children they teach. This is what happens when successive governments overfund fee-charging schools with the fewest needy students and underfund schools serving communities with the highest needs. The OECD says Australia has one of the most segregated schooling systems in the developed world, with increasing concentrations of disadvantaged kids in disadvantaged schools. Moreover, that concentration is growing at the second fastest rate in the developed world. We now have schools that are no longer fit for purpose, where you can hear the classrooms on either side all day long, with doors that don't shut, windows that don't open, ancient toilets and strings of demountables. One high school in Victoria is expecting 13 classes of new Year 7 students. All will be starting in demountable classrooms. The latest versions are higher quality, but many have unreliable internet connections and air conditioning. A teacher in an urban middle-class area lamented that not only would her students not get a fancy bus driving them door-to-door, they would not get a bus at all, not even one open to all passengers. The recent privatisation of bus services has led to the cancellation of the route that used to go past her school's door. Demountables are common in public school playgrounds because schools are often unsure how many kids will turn up on the first day. The local school-age population is no longer the guide to enrolments it once was. Uniquely, and not in a good way, Australia publicly funds its schools to cannibalise one another. This country is the only one in the world that publicly funds two systems. One has all the rights to charge fees, service the communities they choose, enrol only the children they select, and the other has all the responsibilities for compulsory education, to accept all comers, to not charge fees. A more rigged playing field is hard to imagine. I asked teachers from a range of different public schools, from leafy inner city suburbs to schools at the coalface of poverty, and some in regional and rural areas of New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, what their students would and would not get when they returned to school. All sounded the same note of proud defiance. They know the deficits of their schools, and many feel resentment as they pass luxuriously resourced, publicly funded private schools on their way to work. One principal pointed out that his students would get comparable education outcomes for a fraction of the price. Greater socioeconomic and social diversity, which helps build resilience, and more inclusive education for non-neurotypical students. What he said they would not get is more of stress, particularly about results. This was mentioned a few times, and given the rising rates of anxiety and mental health issues in young people, it's no small thing. Indeed, one school counsellor said that students in public schools could rely on getting fully qualified school psychologists, even if they were sometimes doing their work in a converted storeroom or in an office that was not soundproofed. Speaking of confidentiality constraints, another teacher lamented that their school is so short on space that four deputies are forced to share an office. Pity the poor parent who wants to talk about a problem in private. One teacher at a disadvantaged regional New South Wales school sounded the same proudly defiant note when she described her Year 7s as being carefully guided and supported in the transition to their new school environment. In an email listing what they'll receive, she noted a welcome pack of essential learning materials such as pens, pencils and exercise books, support to buy uniforms, access to a learning support team, a well-being team and school counselling services, plus two dedicated teams working to build community for First Nations children. Included in the list is, quote, a library, !! The exclamation marks say everything about the rarity of this feature for public schools today. Her list of what students would not get includes an on-site pool and manicured grounds, as well as personal access to a laptop or device. They are borrowed via a booking system. There will be no consistent and reliable heating and cooling in this regional school, in an area subject to extremes of heat and cold. Importantly, though, these students will also not be expelled or asked to change schools based on not meeting the school's standards. A teacher in an urban middle class area lamented that not only would her students not get a fancy bus driving them door to door, they'd get no bus at all, because as mentioned, the recent privatisation of bus services led to the cancellation of the route. Teacher after teacher pointed out that their public schools would not get full funding according to their SRS until 2034, despite the recent deals the Albanese government struck with the states. In other words, not until this week's cohort of fresh, shiny-faced kindergartners are in year 8. Despite all this, public schools continue to punch above their weight, as there is no difference in academic results between private and public schools when adjusted for socioeconomic status, which is a bit of an indictment of private schools, given that, bar a handful in the Northern Territory, every single one of them is funded above its SRS. Some way, way above. What are they doing with all that money if not getting better results? The one thing private schools won't get when their students come back this year is any conditions tied to their generous public funding, beyond obeying the law and teaching the curriculum. They will not be expected to take on more responsibility for the compulsory education of all students, to hang on to students who are failing, or to remain open in areas of failing enrolments or locations that are uneconomic. They won't be asked to cap their fees, despite an annual trend of increases above the rate of inflation, which has led to private school fees becoming the equal fourth most common cause of bankruptcy in this country. Nevertheless, if the public school teachers I spoke to are any guide, what public school children will get when they return to their less than salubrious schools in 2026 is highly motivated teachers who feel passionately about giving their students the very best opportunities they can. If only our politicians were similarly motivated. Indeed. It's time for a quick break here on the Dogs program. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Welcome back to the Dogs program, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now we're going to pass over to Andy to talk about what many public school communities and parents are doing to try and alleviate some of the costs associated with going back to school. Over to you, Andy.
Parents look for ways to save money on extracurriculars, lunches, uniforms and laptops before school goes back. This was written by Lottie Twyford and published by the ABC on Wednesday the 14th of January. Katie Soll's eldest daughter Annika is only 8 years old, but the Western Sydney mum of three is already thinking about how to manage impending expenses like a laptop for her daughter when she starts high school. Already under financial pressure amid rising bills and rent, Ms. Soul, who has two children in public school, plans to start putting funds away each fortnight to make that happen. She estimates she spends about $400 to $500 on her children's education over 6 months, taking into account extracurricular activities, uniforms and school supplies. One of the other big education-related expenses is school lunches. In that regard, Ms. Soul, who is on a pension, turns to the local school community pantry to supplement her fortnightly grocery bill of about $200 to $300. That is despite her feeling like it can be embarrassing to do so. "I've relied pretty heavily on them in the past couple of years," she said. "They have helped keep food in my kids' tummies and make sure that I can do healthy lunches for them with lots of fruit, veggies and snacks. It changes everything about how they feel." The low-income household also receives support from the national charity The Smith Family for uniforms and school supplies, including lunchboxes and hats. That support has meant the difference between Ms. Soul's kids having cheaper shoes, which last only a few months, and quality sneakers that last a year. "It changes everything about how they feel," she said. "When you have to resort to the cheaper shirts, they feel a bit embarrassed." The local PCYC's low-cost boxing classes have also been a solution to what would otherwise be expensive extracurricular activities for her children, and a breakfast club helps provide additional nutrition before school. The growing cost of essentials. According to a recent survey of families supported by the Smith Family, more than 85% were worried about meeting the cost of school essentials this year. More than half of the 1,100 families surveyed by the charity thought their children would miss out on a digital device, while 51% said increased costs of everyday expenses like groceries, energy costs and rent made it harder to afford school items. Smith Family Victoria General Manager Anton Leschen said the group, which supports low-income families, was concerned to hear about the increasing financial pressures families were under. "Parents are concerned about their capacity to meet the costs of their child's education, and this includes uniforms, excursions, sporting activities and co-curriculars," he explained. "These aren't nice-to-have things for families and students. These are learning essentials." About 72,000 Australian children are on the charity's learning programs, part of an estimated 750,000 children who live below the poverty line. "When you're not ready to learn, when you don't fit in, without the right uniform, without the same books and pens that everybody else in the classroom has, then you lose your confidence and you don't want to go," he explained. Compromises and sacrifices. In Queensland, mum of eight, Laura Sheenan, who is also feeling the brunt of cost pressures, has made the decision not to purchase her high school-aged daughter a digital device. Instead, she works on paper. "As far as I know, we're the only family that has put our foot down and said we couldn't afford that," she explained. In other areas, Ms. Sheenan asks for help from her extended family, including her mum, when it comes to bulk purchases like new school uniforms. She says she is also no stranger to being upfront with her children's schools and saying she simply cannot afford the required uniforms or stationery. Ms. Sheenan, who lives with a disability south of Brisbane, also turns to community-based organisations for a hand with school supplies. One of those is a Logan-based charity, Kids for Kids. The group relies on donations of supplies like backpacks, lunchboxes, water bottles, books and stationery. Volunteers then put together kits for local families who may not otherwise be able to afford new supplies each year, which are distributed. "It's great to be able to come here and know that at least the book list is taken care of," Ms. Sheenan explained. "They're the same brand as everybody else. They're the same, you know, type of thing that you'd go buy in the shop. You can't really tell." Chief Executive Tanya Glancy said the need was clearly growing in the community, with the number of families supported by the small charity doubling each year. "Families are feeling the pinch and they don't have enough in the budget to be able to afford school supplies," she said. On the other side of the country, Collie-based mum Katrina Pays, who also received support from the Smith family, said costs associated with her children's education were growing. Her children range in age from 6 to 17, and their expectations about branded shoes, clothes and new uniforms, as well as fees associated with electives, were all on the up. "Last year I had the expense of the Year 6 camp and the graduation dinner and trying to get clothes for that. So that was all a little bit more tricky," Ms. Pays explained. Her preference was to buy her children new uniforms when possible and then hand them down, rather than purchasing secondhand. "They might wear it for a couple of years as opposed to a year," she said. "With the primary school, those shirts are $30. For high school, they are $40. So you factor in a couple of those, it all adds up." At one Brisbane school, more parents than ever before had been turning to the second-hand uniform shop run by the PNC to save on uniform costs. Craigsley State School PNC President Joel Miller says the concept is simple. Parents give back old uniforms for the shop to sell, and then the proceeds of the sale go to the initial family. "People might be looking at only spending between $5 and $10 for a second-hand uniform piece, down from about $30 to $40 new." Mr. Miller said more people than ever before had been using the second-hand uniform shop as parents looked for ways to keep back-to-school costs down. "A lot of our uniforms come through in really good quality, so they don't look too different to a brand new uniform," he said. As long as the kids all look the same, they want to look like their friends. To help in other ways as costs rose, the suburban school also offered free fruit through the tuck shop and ran a pay it forward program in which parents could pass on a few dollars to support others. Queensland PNC's chief executive Scott Wiseman said he was aware of the widespread impact the rising cost of living on families, with a survey it ran finding 50% of state school families were struggling to make ends meet. He encouraged families who were doing it tough to reach out to their schools for support, as there were many programs in place that could help with food, uniforms, and even the expense of digital devices. You can do it anonymously to the principal or the school leadership and just say we're struggling a bit, he said.
Thanks, Andy. And you've got another article for us now with another five ways for parents in public schools to save.
The start of a new school year can be a costly time for families. Five ways to save. This article was actually published a couple of years ago on the ABC News site, written by Evan Wallace, but it's still entirely relevant now. While the return to school can be a welcome break for many parents and carers, it can also be a period of increased costs and financial strain. Emergency relief services are anticipating record demand for assistance as many families struggle to make it from one week to the next. For Launceston mother of four, Penny Gibson, the new year and finding the money to support her three school-aged children is a juggling act. We kind of save up for it towards the end of the year, Ms. Gibson said. We're having to penny pinch where we can and really think about it more than we were beforehand. With term one less than 3 weeks away in some parts of the country, here are some tips to keep in mind as the bills pile up. 1. Shop creatively for school uniforms. The cost of a school uniform is often an unavoidable expense. According to cost comparison website Finder, the average cost of a full uniform kit is $245 for primary school students and $469 for secondary school students. For many families, Facebook Marketplace has become the go-to location to find secondhand uniforms, including for Ms. Gibson. We use Marketplace heaps, and there are lots of Facebook groups for uniforms that we use, she said. So if you've got someone coming out of a size but going up to the next, you can definitely swap with other parents. Jemima Rigby has also managed huge savings for her school-aged daughter using Facebook Marketplace. I just picked up a jumper for $20 rather than paying $80 brand new, so it saves me much more money, she said. While some schools can be particularly strict on uniform policies, if the option is there, cheaper versions of the same or similar item can sometimes be found at major retailers. 2. Reuse as much as you can. Claire Harris, the founder of children's support group Tassie Mums, said parents should try to reuse equipment and clothing from one year to the next. Reuse as much as you can, she said. Chuck the school bag, the pencil case, the hat, the shoes, everything in the wash, and it will come up a treat. In addition to not feeling as though you have to follow the school equipment list to the letter, Ms. Harris said parents and carers should reach out to schools to see what type of assistance was on offer. A lot of schools have safeguarding officers now. They're a great place to start and talk to if you need some help, she said. Teachers can also help their students as well. 3. No interest loans and financial assistance. The price of a new laptop or tablet for your child's school might be one of the ugliest numbers that you'll see all year. Across the country, no-interest loan schemes are available to support those on low incomes who have the capacity to repay a loan. The loans can be used to pay for essential goods and services, including electronic devices. As the name suggests, the loans are interest-free, do not include fees or charges, and are run by charities across the country. While some schools will have their own support programs on offer, there are organisations that can lend a hand. The National Saver Plus program can help support you with hefty education bills, but some planning is needed. Eligible participants set a savings goal for educational expenses, and when it is reached in a 10-month period, the amount is matched, up to $500. 4. Reach out for support. Sarah Mitchell from the education charity The Smith Family said there were often community organisations from which families could access support. It's just really important that no child should miss out on the essentials that they need for school, Ms. Mitchell said. Tap into whatever resources you have in your community, whether it's a neighbourhood house, the Child and Family Centre. As many community supports that you can get around your family, the more opportunities available for your children. And 5, sports vouchers. On top of all the basics, you might also be budgeting for your child's extracurricular activities. In some states, voucher programs, such as Fair Play in Queensland and Kidsport in Western Australia, are on offer for eligible families. The vouchers provide cash back to help cover the costs of your child's participation in sporting programs. Keep a close eye online, as timeframes to apply for the vouchers can be tight.
Thanks so much for that, Andy. And now I'm going to pass you over to Jeff, who's going overseas. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. It's no secret that I've been avoiding the news of the United States merely because it's pretty depressing and it seems to suck all the oxygen out of the room. So much of it's been drawn into the orange twits world, and things in the States are terrible. So that's no other word for it. Democratic norms seem to have been slipping away. I'm going to focus on one aspect of that today, which is the effect it's having on education and kids who are from other cultures, immigrants, that sort of thing. This is an article from the Hechinger Report, H-E-C-H-I-N-G-E-R, by Alexandra Villarreal. Now, this article is... I'll just read it, I think. But I will say one thing first, which is there's a joke going around. It's a black humour joke, of course, which is what's the difference between the Nazis or the Gestapo and ICE? It's the Gestapo didn't wear masks. Anyway, here's the article. It's called Fear, Arrests and Know Your Rights, How One School District is Grappling with ICE Coming to Town. As students in New Haven, Connecticut are detained, their schools are fighting back. New Haven, Connecticut. They took her, they took her, they took her. Those are some of the words Assistant Principal Cora Munoz could discern while on the phone with the guardian of one of her students. As the caller sobbed and struggled to speak, Munoz realised that immigration enforcement agents had detained a kid from Wilbur Cross, the high school she helps lead, again. There was a reason why Munoz was a go-to contact for the student and her guardian. She, and New Haven Public Schools more broadly, have worked hard to earn the trust of immigrant families in their diverse district. Even as the second Trump administration has made it easier for immigration officers to enter schools and launched a mass deportation campaign, the district's teachers and administrators have nurtured deep relationships with immigrant-serving organisations and helped kids access resources, attorneys, social workers, food, when needed. They've hosted sessions to inform students about their rights and sent home cards with legal information in case of an encounter with immigration officers. And when the worst has happened, when someone's child or parent has been detained, which has occurred over and over in recent months, they have taken immediate action, writing letters in support of the family, members' freedom, our family members' freedom, and raising money alongside a larger coalition of advocates trying to bring that person home. In these moments where it's hard, you show up, said Munoz, and you do what you can. Yet nothing has been able to entirely snuff out the fear of deportation inside the city's schools, say students and educators. That may have contributed to a decline in October and the number of English language learner students enrolling. Their numbers dropped by more than 2,000, or nearly 3.8%, across Connecticut between fall 2024 and fall 2025, and by hundreds, or 7.3% in New Haven, with many immigrant families who are expecting to return to school simply disappearing. Chronic absenteeism rates fell in New Haven during the 24-25 academic year, but after President Donald Trump took office, students said their families told them to skip extracurriculars or early college courses at a university campus in case immigration enforcement was around. For some, a college degree has started to feel more out of reach, just as they adjust their dreams to fit within a new anti-immigrant reality. Teachers have seen kids stop participating in class after friends have been detained, and they wonder if they could be next. I live with fear, said Dee, a high school student from Central America who has lived in New Haven for 2 years. His full name, like those of some others in this story, is being withheld for safety reasons. Sometimes I don't even want to attend school because it makes me afraid to go out of the house. In many school districts around the country, immigrant enrollment is down, as far fewer asylum seekers are able to reach the United States, and some immigrants have chosen to self-deport to avoid the spectre of detention. That said, the consequences of Trump's mass deportation campaign on immigrants' education vary greatly depending on the community, its demographics, and the level of enforcement activity there, said Julie Sugarman, Associate Director for K-12 Education Research at the DC-based Migration Policy Institute and the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. In the Minneapolis area, for instance, where a federal officer shot and killed Renee Good after she dropped off her 6-year-old at school, districts are offering a virtual learning option for the many kids who are staying home in fear. We are definitely hearing anecdotally that there are kids not going to school, Sugarman said. obviously losing a whole year of education, or however long they're not in school, they are missing out on opportunities to develop their content knowledge, to learn literacy, to develop English, and also to develop academic skills in their native language. With 7 institutions of higher learning in the area, New Haven is known as a college town, but it's also a city of immigrants. More than 1 in 6 New Haven residents are foreign-born, a statistic that underscores a point of pride for many who welcome the city's diversity. Families in the public school system speak more than 70 languages. At the Roberto Clemente Leadership Academy, a K-8 school with around 430 students, notices go home in English and Spanish, Pashto and Arabic. The school's front doors have welcome signs posted in multiple languages, and on a bright red poster in the hallway, photos of beaming children surround a message: "We all smile in the same language." When Trump has argued that immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, nixed guidance in January that had generally restricted US Immigration and Customs Enforcement from going into schools to arrest people, New Haven Public Schools Superintendent Madeline Negron was prepared. Ahead of Trump's inauguration, her team reviewed how the district had protected students during his first term and in what ways they could fortify their response. They developed a district-wide policy on how to act if ICE officers sought to enter their buildings. It involves a series of steps, including legal counsel's verification of a valid warrant before immigration agents would ever be allowed in. Without that, no one is going to walk through my doors, because my obligation is to keep every single one of my children safe, said Negron, who also shared the policy in a letter to parents. Negron, in an effort to train all administrators in the protocol and then those staff, helped to train all 2,900 district employees, including custodians, cafeteria workers, teachers, security guards and secretaries. Some schools went even further, holding Know Your Rights presentations for students and their families. Things like a judicial versus administrative warrant. You know, I wish that no kid in New Haven needed to know that, said Ben Scudder, a social studies teacher in the high school and community. Just as an aside, that administrative warrant was deemed unlawful and unconstitutional by a Minnesota judge, I believe. Back to the article. We live in a world where they do, and their families do, so we're going to make sure that they get the training they need to do that, they said. So far, ICE hasn't tried to enter New Haven's public schools, but outside of the classroom, arrests and family separations abound. In June, a mother and her 2 children, an 8-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl, both US citizens, were in their car going to school when vehicles on the street surrounded them and men in ski masks approached. The kids watched, crying, as the immigration agents handcuffed their mum and led her away. Staff members at the Roberto Clemente Leadership Academy, which the kids attend, fundraised for gift cards to grocery stores and delivery services to help their 2 students. They wrote support letters for the mother's immigration case, asking for her release. But around a month later, she was deported to Mexico. Now, whenever the younger siblings sees someone in uniform at school, a security officer, security guard, a police officer, he asks them why they took his mum, said Adela Jorge, Clement's principal. He's not able to understand what happened, Jorge said. All he knows is that his mother was taken. Soon after that, 2 Wilbur Cross students were nabbed, one after the other. First was an 18-year-old named Estras, arrested at his summer job, shuffled to detention facilities around the country, and almost put on a removal flight to Guatemala. After more than a month, with the help of advocacy groups, his attorney, teachers' union, government officials and school employees who came together during summer break, Estras was released. When he returned to Wilbur Cross, he told staff members all he wanted to was to be normal, a request they have tried to honour by quietly reintegrating him into classes. Then, shortly after the start of the new academic year, another student, the one whose guardian had called Munoz in a panic, was detained. At first, I thought she was mad at me or something, said 17-year-old Melanie, recalling when her friend suddenly stopped responding to phone messages. But when she didn't come to school, it really scared me. And I asked the teachers, but they couldn't tell me anything. Her friend was eventually freed too, but teachers and administrators say they're fed up that their students keep being targeted and treated so poorly. They're our kids, and they're being detained in these cages. And the day before, they were eating pizza in our cafeteria, said Matt Brown, the Wilbur Cross principal. Rumours and fears at times disrupt learning. One day in mid-October, around 10:20 a.m, immigration agents in tactical gear were seemingly staging in a park near a New Haven area college, setting off concerns that students were their targets. But about 20 minutes later, the agents instead hit a car wash in Hamden, Connecticut, arresting its workers. I don't know what rights they had in those moments. It didn't seem like they had any. There were no rights there, said Laurie Sweet, a state representative whose district includes Hamden. I think the intention is to cause chaos and make people feel destabilised, and that definitely is what happened. ICE took 8 people into custody that day, some of them parents of school-aged children. Tabitha Sudio, executive director of Connecticut Students in for a Dream, said her organisation searched school records for the kids, trying to ensure they were okay, but no one could find them. We just hope and pray to God that they are able to have someone to pick them up from school, Sukdio said. Teachers say all of this has made immigrant students quieter, more reserved, more observant, and more hopeless. Kids who used to exchange greetings with their teachers in the halls now trudge around like the walking dead or ask for passes to leave the classroom more often. I've seen a lot more sadness. I've seen a lot more students who are good students skipping classes. And it's for no reason except that they just, you know, they have too much going on emotionally to make them go to their classes, said Fatima Nushkiu, a teacher of English as a second language at Wilbur Cross International Academy. Sukdio has noticed a drop in students in at her organisation's college access program as they question why they would try to get a college degree when they don't know whether they'll be in the US tomorrow. You're sitting next to them, she said, of the high schoolers she works with, and they're literally shaking. Many of the kids already have a pile of pressures to navigate. In some cases, they are living in the country by themselves, balancing school with jobs that allow them to send money home to parents and siblings. D, for example, came to the US, leaving behind his mum and 3 younger siblings, and lives in New Haven alone, all to give his family members who remain abroad a better life. And then there's always the next arrest, constantly looming. Do we anticipate having kids detained again, said Brown? I haven't seen anything that would make me think we shouldn't. That's the end of the article. I'm just going to briefly mention an article that appeared on Diana Ravitch's blog, and just to give you the start of it, she says, the Department of Homeland Security decided that ICE agents were exempt from the Fourth Amendment, which prevents police from entering homes without a warrant signed by a judge. US District Court Jeffrey Bryan ruled last Saturday in Minneapolis that ICE had to abide by the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment in the American Constitution says the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched or the persons or things to be seized. This means that law officers can't burst into your home without a judge's warrant. The Fourth Amendment underpins the phrase that a man's home is his castle. But recently, ICE decided that its agents did not need a judge's warrant and that an administrative warrant would suffice. The administrative warrant could be signed by an ICE employee. ICE decided that with an administrative warrant, it could batter down doors and enter homes to seize suspects. Federal Judge Bryan said they could not. Anyway, I won't read the whole article, but that's an ongoing battle between the rule of law and the rule of a fascist takeover, where the Trump administration is already in defiance of Congress's law, which Trump actually signed, to release the Epstein files, for example. And they're in defiance of multiple amendments of the Constitution. And the American people, we wish them luck in their fight. And we note that also Barack Obama joined with Bill Clinton in issuing statements from each of them condemning the current situation and urging Americans to rise up to protect their democracy. Its effect on education and kids, it seems like a small thing, but it's where everything begins. So the Dogs stand firmly with public education and also with democratic principles that underpin most democracies, and we hope the Americans can see their way through this period. With that, I'm going to pass it back to the headquarters of the Dogs, and cheerio.
Thanks so much for your work, Jeff. I think it's time for us to take a quick break here on the Dog.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
Welcome back to the Dogs program, the Defence of Government Schools program here on 3CR Community Radio. And now an interesting article on what's not so great, a slide in attendance. This is an article by Jonathan Cueto that was in The Educator. The quiet slide in school attendance. Australia faces a mounting challenge in its classrooms. On any typical school day in 2025, about 11% of students are absent. This marks a sharp rise from 7% in 2014 and reflects a trend education experts say demands urgent national attention. The Grattan Institute's recent analysis shows the problem extends well beyond a small group of chronically absent students. 2 in 5 students now miss about one day of school each fortnight on average, while the share of students attending regularly, defined as at least 90% of the time, has fallen from 71% in 2019 to just 59% in 2024. The academic cost. Research shows every single day of absence affects student achievement. A study examining NAPLAN results in Western Australia found each missed day was linked to lower scores across numeracy, reading, and writing. The ripple effects extend beyond individual students, adding pressure on teachers, managing catch-up work, disrupting classmates' learning, and increasing the burden on parents balancing work and care responsibilities. Behind the absences. An analysis of records from nearly one-third of Australian government students from the first year of school through to year 12 between 2017 and 2024 identifies illness as the main driver of rising absences. Students missed an average of 11.6 days for illness or medical appointments in 2024, up from 6.6 days in 2017, an extra week per student. Family-related absences, including term time holidays, have more than doubled since 2017, averaging about 4 days in a year in 2024. Meanwhile, disciplinary absences, such as suspensions, have remained low and stable. Learning from England. England's response to similar post-pandemic attendance challenges offers a possible roadmap. Since making school attendance a system-wide priority in 2021, England has lifted its attendance rate to 94% compared with Australia's 89%. The approach includes daily attendance reporting by schools, improved data dashboards for school leaders, and coordinated meetings between education, health, policing, and children's services leaders. Health professionals in England have also issued guidance on attending school with mild illness, while medical bodies have recommended scheduling appointments outside school hours where possible. the path forward. Federal and state education ministers have committed to lifting Australia's school attendance rate back to 91%, the 2019 level, by the end of the decade. The Grattan Institute says the target will require more than minor adjustments. It will depend on better data systems, clearer health guidance for families, and coordinated action across sectors to ensure every child can learn every day. All right, so let's move on to our great part of the program, our great state school of the week.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week.
State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Mortlake College. A message from the principal. As a P-12 school, we believe a great strength is our ability to provide a seamless transition between primary and secondary schooling, as we have an extensive knowledge of every student's learning and social needs. There are many things that I believe make our school an inclusive and vibrant learning community. This is made up of the broad selection of programs and learning opportunities for our students to engage in. Our school has a focus on continuous improvement in every aspect of school life. We aim to maximise each student's potential so that all will experience success. Our school goals focus on improving our students' levels of achievement in all domains of the curriculum. Our school has three distinct learning teams to develop and deliver curriculum at the different stages of learning, acknowledging age-appropriate needs. The physical layout of the school reflects the sub-school groupings with areas for P-6 and 7 to 12. We operate a vertical curriculum for years 7 to 12, which broadens the range of subject choices for students and provides a structure for students to work at a level more suited to their needs. Our house system is an important aspect of school life, with all students aligned to one of the houses. The house names reflect the school's philosophy: inspire, endeavour, succeed. Our school provides students with the opportunity to excel in a range of enrichment programs: performing arts, which includes production and festival performances, public speaking, instrumental music, sporting teams, and camps and excursions at all year levels, including tours of New Zealand. We combine the best of a traditional approach to teaching with innovative and exciting programs at all levels. Schools are dynamic places, and good relationships underpin the foundations of our school. Every day, I genuinely walk into our school with a real sense of optimism and enthusiasm. I just love the energy that exists in a school environment. There is a strong partnership between parents and staff, with a high level of participation in classroom programs such as classroom helpers, and also in broad school activities and programs such as the school productions. We have an active parents association who support the school in many ways, including through fundraising activities. Mortlake College is proud of its achievements in student learning. We have a strong focus on literacy and numeracy at all levels, and we support students with strong literacy and numeracy intervention programs. Individual learning plans strengthen our results by addressing the needs of individual students. One of the great strengths of our school has been our excellent VCE results over a long period of time. In 2020 and 2021, our school was listed in the top 10 VCE performers in regional Victoria. The VCAL certificate was also introduced in 2020 to broaden our pathway options to students. Our staff is committed to giving students the best possible chances to maximise their results through smaller class sizes and knowledge of individual student learning. In the Attitudes to Schools survey, our student responses are above the state average. This indicates the students at both primary and secondary levels have a strong sense of belonging and an enjoyment of school. Positive education and respectful relationship principles are designed to provide students with an understanding of what factors assist in creating a sense of well-being. We use the restorative practices model of behaviour management. Each student is aware that they will be held accountable for their behaviour and will be dealt with fairly and consistently. Mortlake P-12 College has a real sense of community because it is filled with people who care and want to see success. We look forward to achieving success together. And that's a statement from Linda Musik, the principal. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. Current enrolment, 191. And the ICSEA value, well below average, at 957, representative of a small rural community.
The upper 25% of parental incomes make up 5% of students. The second level, 17% of students. 31% of students have parents in the third quartile of incomes, which is below 50%, and the lowest quartile of parental incomes make up 47% of students, with 4% coming from a language background other than English and 8% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government of $1.1 million and the Victorian government $4 million. Private fees at $108,000 and other contributions $96,000. And that works out at $28,421 per pupil. And the capital, $160,548 over 3 years.
Congratulations to Mortlake College. You are our Great State School of the Week. Just like to remind our listeners that it is coming up to 3CR's annual subscriber drive. So if your subscription to 3CR is not up to date, this is your reminder that it's time to subscribe to 3CR. Well, that's all we've got time for here today, but I'll just let you know that we will be following what the AEU Victoria are doing, and we will be supporting any action they take, because our teachers in Victoria are the least paid in Australia and our public schools are the least funded in Australia. So much for the education state. We'll be watching what goes on. If you'd like to find out more about the Dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. That's www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at the Dogs and from 3CR, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.